You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, 88.1 in Ithaca and 91.9 in Watkins Glen. And our guest on this hour is Jacob Parker Carver. Now, do you prefer Jacob or Jake?
I prefer Jake.
Okay, Jake. I have a Jacob who prefers definitely Jacob. So anyway, so Jake, it's good to have you on the show this morning.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
And what we begin the show with is this big question, which allows us to just have a starting point. Who are you? What do we need to know to start this conversation about your life and some of the things you value?
Okay, that's a really good start. We already covered my name. We got that done. My name is Jake Parker Carver. I am originally from Trumansburg, born and raised there. I went to Ithaca College after graduating from Trumansburg High School. Went through the Park School of Communications. I am a proud Parky IC alum. And then spent a couple years teaching English in Shanghai, China.
Wow.
Which was a fascinating experience. Very glad that I got to do that. And just came back to this area in the summer of 2014. When I first came back, I was employed as a skill builder at the Mental Health Association. A skill builder is someone who works one-on-one with at-risk youth, children who have emotional or behavioral issues that put them at risk of being taken away from their families and put in residential treatment facilities, which was really difficult but right. Really rewarding work. They're looking for people right now if anyone out there is interested in something like that. But staying at the Mental Health Association and getting to use my communications background, the community ed position, which I'm in now, I'm now their community educator, seemed like a really good fit. So very happy and proud to be there.
And back in the Ithaca area, back in Trumansburg, indefinitely or...
Yep. Yep. I'm here for the foreseeable future. Uh-huh. I loved this area growing up. In my adolescence, I went through a phase where I wanted to, spread my wings, kick out, and I got as far away as I could go by going to China.
Yeah.
But I missed it. I've traveled all over the world. I've seen a lot of really beautiful places. But there's a part of my heart that I recognize was always going to be here. And living on Main Street, T-Berg now, it's where I need to be.
Okay.
And I'm very glad to be back.
Well, Jake, you brought music with you, and the first one I think is Glass Animals, Life Itself. Do you want to say anything about this, or just listen to it and let it be?
I think we can dive into it. I love the Glass Animals, and I love life itself, so let's just go for it.
All puns intended.
Yep.
Sonic Ray Gun, gonna be a superstar. I can't get a job, so I live with
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Jake Parker Carver. So Jake, what have some of, I mean, you mentioned a number of things that you've done. What are some of the experiences or some of the commitments that you've lived by that you have learned from, so that the life you live and aspire to live now is shaped by them? What has shaped you, and how do you rely on that for the lessons going forward?
That's a really good question. I'll try to address that the best I can. So the first thing that pops into my head is the experience of having been homeschooled when I was young.
Uh-huh.
I was really, really lucky the circumstance that I popped out into as a kid. My mom and my dad lived across the street from my maternal grandparents, and one of my aunts and my uncle lived with my grandparents as well. So those three parental units were really close to me growing up. So they decided when it was going to be time for me to go into school that they were going to take that on themselves. So instead of going into the public school system, you know, I learned history from my grandma. I learned science from my uncle. My dad taught me math. My mom taught me French. And it was just such a wonderful way to learn. I got so much individualized attention.
Uh-huh.
I got so much care. And I was being taught by people based on their interest and their expertise. And I just value that so much. It's something that I've really recognized, you know, the work that I've done with youth since then,
mm-hmm.
How hard it is to be a kid who's spending 8 hours a day at a desk, you know, processing information that way, as opposed to, you know, me with a relative who loves me unconditionally sitting with me on a swing set and talking to me about history.
Right.
There's such a different context to how someone learns.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's absolutely a definitive part of who I am and how I process the world around me now. Also, you know, building off of that experience, you know, it was years before I think I ever had a conversation, a full conversation with someone that didn't unconditionally love me, uh-huh. and was spoiled in that regard. And that also, you know, defined a lot of my worldview. For a lot of years, I just kind of assumed that, everyone was going to treat each other with that amount of respect and compassion. And it was interesting recognizing at a certain point, at a certain age, that, you know, when it really clicked that that's not how everybody operated.
Right.
And, you know, addressing the part of your question about, you know, personal mission and our commitments, I definitely take it as, you know, part of my daily goal to reintroduce that to people, to one step at a time, encourage people to treat each other that way.
Right.
Because I know that it's possible.
Right, right, right. I'm real tempted to go down that path right now, but I think we might ought to. How old did you say you were when you had that first conversation that showed you that people, there's somebody who didn't kind of unconditionally love you
I'm sure that I had some conversation before this age, but when I went to high school, when I was 13, I think was when it really clicked for me,
right.
That, you know, people, not only were people not treating each other with that, but some people didn't have that at home either.
Right, 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 right. How has that, okay, so you say you try to bring this into your work. What is that you're bringing in? What is the quality of regard, and how do you monitor yourself to know that you're giving it, or how do you know they've been able to receive it?
I think it's about treating people with respect and compassion, and kind of like training yourself to refrain from making the judgments that our in our minds are constantly making of each other.
Or at least not to make them, but not hold on to them, not get stuck in them.
Right, right. And, you know, without calling anyone, you know, a judgmental person, because no one wants that label, and I strive very hard to not be a judgmental person myself, but that's just part of our inner monologue, and it's part of how we're programmed, and it's part of what keeps us safe in some scenarios. We're mm-hmm. supposed to be looking for dangers. We're supposed to be looking for things that are strange and are different. That's part of our internal protective mechanism, but it can go too far and it can encourage us to be judgmental or treat people differently or shameful.
Right. Well, the kind of judgment's a problem is a judgment that one clings to against the contrary evidence.
Right.
And or when you lead with a judgment, you can't, the contrary evidence never comes to you because people are too afraid to present it, or they don't know, they're already reacting to you before they've had a chance to show anything of themselves.
Mm-hmm. When a judgment keeps you safe, it's performing a purpose, and then it's right to have made that judgment. When a judgment is tearing down bridges, when a judgment is building walls, then it's something to be examined more closely.
Right. But one of the issues that goes even kind of more deep than conscious judgments is the fact that everything we perceive comes with a positive or negative spin, even before we're aware that we've perceived it with a positive or negative spin.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's holding that awareness lightly rather than, and not indulging it rather than not having it.
Mm-hmm. To add further to the complexity, the beliefs that we hold most deeply, the mm-hmm. things that are the most core parts of our programming, are the things that we're not aware of. So
the unexamined belief, yeah,
right, yeah. Right. So I could tell you the things that are my beliefs, that are my missions, that are my basis for operating, but that can only go so far as the things that I'm consciously aware of.
Right.
But the things that are the truest, most essential part of me are the things that I'm not even able to see.
Right, right. I had a clinical pastoral education supervisor who told the story of he was working with a priest, and he watched the priest give out the host to people coming up for communion, the small wafer of bread, and he noticed that some people, the priest turned his hand in a different way.
Mm.
And he realized these were the people, he had a different opinion about the person. And he asked him a question, and he elicited the idea, these are the persons that he had a hard time with, and that he was in a certain sense cursing rather than blessing.
Mm.
And it was unconscious, completely unconscious
mm.
in his behavior, but it could read to anybody who knew him. And we make our judgments known even when we're not aware of the fact that we made them.
That is a really perfect and beautiful example. I like that. One of the things that I like about that story is that it's a priest who's going through that situation, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which illustrates, no one is above it.
Right.
We are human. This is part of our condition that we shouldn't guilt ourselves or shame ourselves for having that be part of our programming. But that a better way to operate for all of us is to be consciously aware of our own limitations in that regard and strive towards treating each other without that judgment.
Right. And the way to approach it is not with judgment, but with, do you realize that you handed the host to somebody in a different way, and these were the people that you handed it to differently?
Mm-hmm.
And then what's going on with those people for you? And so that the process of discovering it is something that's mutual rather than a kind of a weapon of judgment. Because to draw awareness of judgment by crushing judgment is not helpful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that was also one of the lessons that the person modeled while still telling the story.
Mm.
And it gets enormously complex. As an educator, what do you find yourself, you're a community educator, and what you've described to me as your way of perceiving or approaching people is one of this kind of openness,
mm.
recognizing that you have an internal judgment meter that's going off all the time, but just trying to maintain the openness while you're aware of the dialogue, but not controlled. That would, for me, be the definition of living in community.
Hmm.
I can be in community with people I find objectionable because there are maybe quite legitimate reasons, but I still need to be able to engage them. And if my judgment gets in the way of engaging them, then we can't function.
Hmm.
But I don't give up the judgment. Because you want to be safe, or you want to be able to know what you can do, and certain people aren't up to things things that are important.
Absolutely. And, you know, working in the field of mental health, a lot of the things that we have to talk about are really sensitive, things that people are afraid to talk about, things that are really, really personal to people. So, you know, talking about being open, I think the best thing that I can do, something that I have to kind of steel myself for every day, is just throwing myself out there in, you know, in a big way. I hope it's not perceived ever as like an arrogance or an egotism, but just I would like to expose my vulnerability by demonstration. So something that I say all the time is, you know, hello, my name is Jig Parker Carver. I'm here to talk to you today about anxiety, and I'm terrified right now. you know, full disclosure, I have a generalized anxiety disorder. The idea that, you know, the things that I say here on the radio today, just imagining how many people are going to hear them is terrifying to me. But, you know, I think the message is going to be heard better from someone who's feeling those feelings than someone who's talking about it because they read about them.
Right, right. And to look at you here, and the listener can't, I can see that you look relaxed, but there is kind of what I would call in your eyes, there's kind of what I could read as anxiety if I knew you really well, but I don't. You know what I'm saying? So anxiety is often masked.
Oh, yeah.
And so you tell us that, and it doesn't fit the stereotype. So we have to take and respect what you just said without necessarily having our judgment confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And that's trust. You know, you've trusted me or in the audience to share what you just said, but we trust that you're telling us what's going on.
I hope so.
Yeah.
And I hope that through experiences like that, that, you know, people who feel similarly to me can be more outspoken about that. You know, through the courses of the conversations I've had, you know, people learn that they identify with certain symptoms, that they've had similar life experiences, that they have similar concerns, and they learn something about themselves, and they see that it's okay to be vocal about that and that they will receive support. I think something that's tricky specifically about anxiety is that, you know, it's a symptom of the condition to be afraid. So
right.
There's the truth about the stigma of all mental health issues, but, you know, specifically with anxiety, it's very scary, the idea of talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people suffer alone. People don't recognize that close to 20% of U.S. adults suffer from a diagnosable level of anxiety because people don't talk to each other about
right.
it. People are afraid of the judgment from each other. And something that's been so beautiful for me to see, and so therapeutic for me in my work, is to see the different portions of the community that I go into, the different groups. And whenever I say that, you know, hello, I'm here and I'm terrified to be speaking in front of you right now, I haven't had anyone throw anything at me yet.
Right.
When I'm vulnerable like that, in every instance, I get an overwhelming show of support.
Mm-hmm.
People end up cheering for me from the first moment. And that's something that's beautiful to see. Our greatest fear is that others will reject us. And the most beautiful thing that we can experience is that acceptance, the opposite of that.
Right.
So to create that is cool.
Right. And to create it as a byproduct while you're working on something else means that you can be anxious, but still have the focus on the purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is really critical, because some people can accept their anxiety, but they don't know how to feel like we can responsibly engage this without being a little too hyper sensitive to it.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, everyone has their own coping mechanisms, mm-hmm. their own way to deal with it. And, you know, something that I hear all the time is, well, you don't look anxious. And, you know, anyone else out there who who feels similarly, I think that's something that they may have heard. And it causes people to doubt their stories,
right?
And which is a whole other challenge in itself. But the truth of the matter is, you know, because we do that as a survival mechanism, because we find ways to hide it, we find ways mm-hmm. to create that, you know, shell of control, you know, you're not going to know necessarily if someone's dealing with that.
Right, right. And I think, and it's tempting to just kind of get judgmental for the people who said, I don't see it. But what we live in a culture that values our being able to empirically verify everything that we know or think we know or believe. And when you can't verify it, the immediate reaction that's sanctioned in this culture is to question it.
Mm-hmm.
And the comeback is that your antenna may be wrong on this subject.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and but it's hard for us to then to say that, because that's really probably what's going on. You know, it's not something that can be read.
Yep. And you know, the worst thing that can happen is that we end up in an us versus them scenario.
Yeah,
the people struggling with this versus the people who aren't. That's not the kind of dynamic that we want to set up at all.
Right, which is means that listening to both sides and honoring their words as not malintent.
Right.
Yeah, as being trustworthy and maybe uninformed or not experienced, or you know, or not, you know, not having the value to trust. I've been around. I've been through bouts with anxiety myself. I've been around people for whom this is a major issue, as we all have, with 20% of the population and probably much more having a diagnosable experience of anxiety that affects their ability to live well. So
live, laugh, and love, because I'm a hippie. That's the way I like to remember it.
Yes.
It's an issue if it impacts your ability to live, laugh, and love to the level you want to.
Yeah. Let's cut to music. What would you like to play next?
Let's go with the 1940.
Okie doke. And this is The Submarines.
The year is 1940. And something isn't right.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Jake Parker Carver. So, Jake, I have a sibling. I mean, I have a relative who I have many siblings.
Congratulations.
Being one of eight means that that's a large family. But one is particularly sensitive to judgment. And is calling out the others to not be judgmental. And that tends to make observations or anything kind of hard to share and makes people a little defensive. How do we handle that? How do we handle the fact that somebody may say something inappropriate or wrong, but not drive them into a defensive position or get them stuck there?
That's an excellent question. And I think in a nutshell, what it boils down to is shared goals. So I think a really unfortunate situation that happens all the time is even though what both people in a situation are going towards is that built bridge, the increased level of empathy and demonstrating compassion for each other, even though that's internally what people want, that it is not felt that way, it is not understood, and there's shame thrown on both sides. So someone might express a judgment out of concern. You know, you're doing this and it's bad for you, so stop.
Or even just consider stopping.
Yep. Yeah. And also, you know, on the other hand, you know, you're a jerk for calling me this. You're a jerk for having said that and, you know, shaming on both sides.
Yeah.
But bringing it back to that shared mission of empathy building and understanding and demonstration of compassion. Mm-hmm. So it's not about, you know, specific action steps necessarily. It's about expression of concern.
Right.
So something that I always like to do is be very mindful to use I statements. Mm-hmm. So instead of saying you should do this, say, you know, I feel this way.
Sure.
It hurts me when you da-da-da-da-da. This has caused this internal meter reading for me. And expressing things in those terms to help build understanding of each other's perspectives, I think, is important.
Right, right. And sometimes, some people want to say, oh, I love you. But when you've had conflict and that statement comes too soon, it doesn't feel genuine, or it feels like it feels conditional, and it can't be clean. Sometimes a cleaner statement is, I wish the best for you as you experience it, and that is a you statement couched in an I that turns it over to the other person. These are very, we get in each other's spaces with these things because our health, our mental health, our emotional health is very much a personal matter.
You know, I love the Beatles, but I would not say that love is all you need. I think there's definitely more to the story than that. I have loved people, and that love that I felt was toxic. I have been loved by people whose love for me was not very healthy.
Right.
And, you know, the love that we feel for each other isn't always the end-all, be-all, final answer.
Right. And earlier in the show, you used an expression which I particularly have trouble with, although I know where it's coming from, unconditional love. And that, on a literal level, very often isn't true, because there are situations where the love is toxic, or the love is whatever. So the ability to receive it isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you use that rhetoric? Is it quick? What makes it compelling in the settings where you work? Because I think I sense that you use it quite a bit.
Well, it's interesting that you make that. That you made that statement. I'm re-examining that. So when I use that statement, I don't actually use it very often. I typically use it just in the context of my family unit. Because outside of that, I think it's extraordinarily rare. I think that we're more likely to find it within our family than we are within most places in our lives. But, you know, professionally, I don't use that statement very much. Okay, outside in the world, I don't use that statement very much, because it's a hard thing for a human to feel. Like, you have to do a whole lot of emotional exercise before you're able to have that type of love for somebody.
And it's not even necessarily a goal if what's coming at you is violence.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't look and see that for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to honor the unconditional love. And I just completed a training, and I heard it a couple of times in reference always to familial or close intimacy relationships, as you had just said.
Mm-hmm.
But even there are things my partner or my family member or my parent could do to me, which I would need to do something that would be unloving in terms of a boundary or a pushing away or a calling police or whatever to take care of myself.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we can get around it. It's just such a loaded statement for me, and that's why I was questioning.
Thank you for expressing that, because you know a lot of what we feel is connected to our emotional attachment to words and to phrases.
Yeah, and I get it.
That's some good clarification.
And in the Christian tradition, that is a large. That concept is at the heart of it, but it's also being a Christian pastor, I've seen it misused. So it's like a third rail. I just try. I know it's there, but I try not to touch it.
Mm.
You know, because it raises pushes buttons.
So one thing that I'd love to add to that, you know, when I think an important point you made is that, you know, sometimes you would need to pull away or you know to isolate yourself.
Right.
And that's okay. And I think that you can love someone through that. So absolutely. I can love someone without being there with them. I don't have to be actively in their presence or engaged with them to love them.
Or thinking about them or whatever. It's just a condition of my regard.
Yep. Yep.
And that's the sense in which I completely get it. But it has been so, We've gotten to the good place, I think, here on this. Yeah,
It is something that I think a lot of people struggle with, mm-hmm. And something that I've seen in a lot of cases that I think is really sad is people say things like, "If you loved me, you would da 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 da," or "I can tell that you don't really love me because da 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 da." And that's some poison right there. Because love isn't about, you know, jumping through a specific set of hoops. And what I do when I love someone is different from what you do when you love somebody. Yeah. There are different languages of love. You know, someone might tell that I genuinely feel affection for them if I, you know, I'm trying to think of like specific people and I can't help thinking about my girlfriend right now. But the fact that I'm the one that wakes up early in the morning enough to like make coffee for both of us, that's a sign that I love her.
Right.
The fact that, you know, I'm the one who will take the dog out in the morning is a sign that I love her.
Right.
Because that's
not something that she can do easily at all. She could do it if she had to, but.
When we take on these roles, when we do something that's outside of ourselves that we wouldn't normally do to demonstrate care for somebody, and it looks different from different people.
Yeah, absolutely.
There are a million ways that she shows me throughout each day that she loves me that bring me to tears, and they're not the same actions that I do for her.
Mm-hmm.
I hope everyone has someone like that in their lives, but it's also true with friendships, with family relationships that, you know, what you do to show care for your parents is definitively different from what your parents do to show care for you.
As it should be, yeah.
Yeah. So recognizing that, you know, the way that someone shows love isn't anything about what you expect them to do, but learning about what matters to them. And recognizing that they're doing that for you.
Right, right. In a certain sense, a gift is an effort to span the space between the giver and the receiver.
Mm-hmm.
And love is just exactly that.
Mm-hmm. And I think this relates in an interesting way to the conversation we had about judgment too, and that there's a responsibility both on the part of the person who is being loved and the person who is loving, right?
Right.
So if I want to do some emotional exercise and increase my ability to feel love, I can work on recognizing what other people in my environment are doing to demonstrate that love for me. Seeing that this person loves books and they just gave me a book, so they must care for me. That this person
and the
really
response is,
this.
Oh, thank you. This is a beautiful gift.
Right.
And not, oh, I've read that book. I don't want that.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, on the other side of the fence, if you know, you want to do some emotional exercise and be more loving, put some work into recognizing, okay, so I don't care about this thing at all, but this matters to this person. So I'm going to find a way to find out more about this so I can demonstrate love to them in a way that translates into their language.
Right. And not just that I generally picked up an item that has that element to it, but I know that this is the particular one. I have some judgment within their space.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Those are beautiful things. Let me do the station ID and let's cut to music briefly and then we'll come back. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Jake Parker Carver. What should we play next?
Let's see.
It's Daydreams or The Jerk.
Based on the conversation we just had, let's do The Jerk. That'd be funny.
Okay.
To make it on my own, but it didn't work. I tried to be with you alone, but it didn't work. I caught the jerk. Sad to see, I love you a lot, but please don't move from me. I did the jerk. I'm not well. Spending it together, I'm sure you could tell. Oh no. A good one's hard to find, I know. LA is the worst. You set the bar extra low. So I come in first, and you know me. And how I do. Fire in my head, but still I will make do. Oh, it's a shame. Ugly mess. Lovely looking thing, but still I won't invest. Oh, no.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and our guest on this hour is Jake Parker Carver.
Hello.
Jake, you work with groups. One of the programs that you, and a lot of them has to do with getting more skillful at taking care of themselves or being attentive to other people's needs. And one of these programs is called Mental Health First Aid. And there's a certificate with that, and you're a responder, just like a first responder for some other kind of healthcare related issue or an EMT kind of thing. But it's mental health. How did you get involved with that program? What do you hope that program to? How do you hope that program to impact this community? Why does it matter?
Excellent questions. I became a mental health first aid trainer about two years ago now. It's an 8-hour course similar to the first aid or CPR that you'd get from the Red Cross or like the American Heart Association. But instead of teaching you how to, help someone who may have had a physical accident, it's helping you identify that someone might be suffering from anxiety or depression or have experienced a traumatic event and how
or
to help them.
Psychosis through, or whatever.
Right. How to help them with those symptoms, and not to diagnose, but to help them with those symptoms and guide them towards appropriate resources. And I think it's an incredibly valuable training. When I first went through the training myself, I was really moved by it, and then sought out an opportunity to become a trainer. Mm-hmm. Because at the time there weren't many in our community. At this point we offer that training about monthly. Mm-hmm. Most months we offer that training at the Tompkins County Public Library. If anyone's interested in registering, they can send me an email at jpc@mhaedu.org or call our offices at 607-273-9250. It's something that meant a lot to me personally. So, you know, part of the training is talking about anxiety and depression and because of their prevalence.
Right.
And those are both things that I've been diagnosed with. So I learned a lot about, you know, my own experience from taking that training, and I learn more about that and how I can handle it myself every time I'm presenting to a group of people mm-hmm. and I hear their stories.
And you learn about how the experience looks to the outside. When mm-hmm. you've been through the experience, you don't necessarily know how it looked to the people around you.
Mm-hmm. Something that, I mean, talking about the outside, talking about sure. the people around me, something that's incredibly valuable to me in those trainings, and I believe is valuable to the people attending the trainings right. as well, is seeing the perspectives of the other people in the room.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we'll have a training with someone from Planned Parenthood and a sergeant from the sheriff's office and, you know, someone from the Child Development Council and, you know, all these people from different aspects of the community are coming together in that training to learn about how to take care of other people in the community.
Right. And it's not a long-term taking care of. It's just in that moment, how do you respond to somebody who seems in trouble.
Mm-hmm. And you're so much more likely to encounter someone who is having a hard time mentally and emotionally, someone who, you know, maybe having a panic attack or who is afraid or who is feeling really sad and is having a hard time vocalizing why. You're so much more likely to encounter that.
And doesn't get up and move. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You're so much more likely to encounter that than to encounter someone who's, you know, broken a leg or gotten into some other sort of accident.
Or having a heart attack or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And not to diminish that value at all, because I'm also first aid and CPR certified, but just to, you know, validate the emotional experience as well, because that's also part of our health.
Right, right. When one of the things that seemed so productive to me about the course was that you get really simple layperson's understandings of what these conditions are, how to recognize enough, not to diagnose, but enough to know that this is the kind of question I could ask, or this is a kind of thing I need to check out responsibly. And it would allow us to engage people earlier and not before they've had a chance to isolate too far.
Mm-hmm.
And to deal with problems much, much earlier. So I was thinking in congregations or in civic associations or neighborhood groups or cultural groups, this would be a wonderful skill for people to have, because these are the front lines that are just outside the boundaries of family. And they're not informal institutions.
Mm-hmm. We talked briefly about the stigma around mental health issues.
Sure.
And I think an unfortunate phenomenon is that because a lot of the language that we use around mental health is clinical, that builds the stigma. So, you know, when we talk about our feelings, it's immediately intense. And, you know, I am not qualified to help you because I'm not a doctor.
Right. Or I'm not a psychologist or whatever.
Right.
Right.
And in, you know, certain situations, like absolutely a clinical level of care is needed.
But you could walk that person to the emergency room or wherever, or stay with them until emergency help mm-hmm. comes if it's that critical.
And I mean, just talking about prevention, you know, typically it's on average 10 years between the time someone first starts feeling the symptoms of a mental health issue and when they first start seeing professional treatment. And I think if we had more people with their feet on the ground who were out there, you know, ready to be compassionate and knew the words to use to demonstrate love, to speak people's love languages,
right, right.
Then, you know, a lot of people wouldn't get to the point where they needed that clinical help.
Right. And I behind that, you know, it takes 10 years. So if you address a problem when it's mild, it never has a chance to become severe or moderate. But if you don't address it until it's moderate, the time to work through all the complications you've made in your life, all the relationships you may have burned or jobs or whatever, it's that much more difficult. Mm-hmm. So the 10-year delay is a loss of a lot of functional life.
Mm-hmm. I always love to create the metaphor between physical health and mental health, because I think that, you know, they exist on a similar spectrum, but we think about them very differently. We all recognize that there are things that we could do to be more physically healthy and things that might happen to us that would make us less physically healthy. But somehow our cultural understanding is that, you know, here in this box are all these people who are mentally ill, and whew, I'm lucky because I'm outside this box over here with the people who are mentally well, and that it's static like that. And that is so very much not
right.
the case.
Right. And a person who has a major depressive episode, only half of people who have one will ever have another one.
Yeah.
And with a psychotic episode, only a third will ever go on to have another one, let alone many. So mm-hmm. it could be an isolated event. And you didn't say how many people over the course of their lifetime will experience a mental health issue.
One in four.
I would have thought it's probably even higher, but that I would guess that that's underreported, but I don't know.
Well, and that's a fair guess. That would be my personal assertion. Yeah. You know, we talk about things in terms of, you know, whether or not they're diagnosable, but a lot of that is based on data with, you know, we're talking to people who have sought help.
Right.
And that is not a lot of the population.
Or you're talking to people to remember historically events that they may have actually blocked out or not be able to access in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
When our lives mm-hmm. are so different than they were at a certain time, it's hard to put yourself back there.
Mm-hmm. Some people are very lucky in that when they're going through a difficult time in their lives, they have, you know, family or friends or, you know, faith communities that take care of them.
Sure.
And maybe they get enough solace from those supports that they never have to see, you know, someone who's part of this system. They never have to seek right. professional help. There are other people who don't have that and are afraid of the system and never get help. And, you know, going back to the physical metaphor, you know, if you had a broken leg and you were ashamed to talk to people about your broken leg, and then you ended up hobbling around on your broken leg for 10 years, the chances of you ever being able to walk the way you used to are pretty
right.
slim.
Right, right, right. You began the training session, because we just did it this past week. You began the training session with the question, what do you do, and you may have never thought about it this way, but what do you do for your own mental health care?
Mm.
And, you know, it could be taking a bath. It could be, you know, taking time to sit quietly. It could be going out for a net run. It could be anything of a whole bunch of stuff, but you're doing it to right yourself. You know, that is wonderful. And that is part of what this show is committed to, is helping people to think about and to hear how other people take care of themselves.
Yay.
So the question that we end the show with is, and then we spend the last 10 or 15 minutes on, is what do you do to take care of yourself emotionally, physically, intellectually? How do you know you need to take care of yourself?
Mm.
And these things, some things we do throughout the day, some things we do daily, weekly, monthly, yearly. So Jake, what do you do to take care of yourself, and how do you know you need to do it?
Real quick, before I actually sure. provide the answer, I just want to underscore that importance, because it's something that, you know, I care a lot about. Something that I find all the time is that these are things that people typically do passively.
Unreflectively.
People aren't consciously making the choices that I'm going to take care of my mental health now, the same way they recognize that when they go for a run, that's taking care of their physical health.
Right.
They get to the point where they're burned out, and then they do something because they can't think of anything else to do.
Right.
As a so, you know, subconscious survival.
Proactive is really, really important, and we don't think of it that way.
Absolutely. You know, something that I do regularly, I am part of a weekly Dungeons & Dragons group. I play Dungeons and Dragons with a group of my friends, and that's a really satisfying form of escapism for me.
Sure.
It's a social activity because I'm surrounded by people that I grew up with, people that I've known since my transition into high school. And it's very therapeutic for me, you know, to get outside of this context where I am, you know, reasoning my way through things and talking my way through things. And for a couple hours once a week, I can be a dwarf with an axe who's fighting a dragon. and I'm problem solving that way.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And that's hugely beneficial to me. I also read. My girlfriend has recently gotten me into comic books. I should have gotten into them long ago, but I'm enjoying that newfound source of support. I'm right now reading Rat Queens, which is about a group of women in a Dungeons & Dragons-esque kind of fantasy world, I'm loving that. Part of my daily maintenance, every day I make sure that I spend at least 10 minutes on my recliner, in my living room, with my feet up, with my cat on my chest. Because when there's a purring cat, like, right over my heart, everything just melts away feels so good. When I do that, it's kind of difficult sometimes. And this is I'm going to refer back to the intentionality here, because there's a minute or so where that's uncomfortable to be doing that. When I'm sitting on the recliner, my feet's up, the cat's on my chest, and I'm really upset with myself for doing that, because I'm thinking about all the things that I have to do, the things that I said wrong during the day, the things that are, you know, coming down the tunnel at me.
The self-judgment that's part of anxiety.
Right. The self-judgment that's attached with not functioning high enough.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I have to remind myself that if I crash and burn and implode, that I'm not ever going to be able to accomplish any of those things. So to go through that to the point where I can relax and let go is hugely important to me. My relationship with my family, since I've been back in the area, I've gotten to see so much more of my parents and my sister. I was living in Shanghai for 5 years, and you know, while I did come back to visit a few times, it's not the same thing as living down the street.
Right.
So I'm so grateful to have them as a greater presence in my life. Mm-hmm. My girlfriend is a constant source of support. She also is working in the mental health field in our community. We like to say that we are each other's caseworkers. Because we do a lot to take care of each other that way.
Right.
So
right.
I'm very, very grateful for her. We have a puppy. Her name is Chloe. She's a combination Shih Tzu Bichon Frise mix. And she's the cutest little thing that ever breathed. So she's a big part of my self-care now. And I've recently taken up whittling.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Which I have really enjoyed. I like got into it for a little while when I was like middle school aged.
That's but kind of tabled age, it. You know, 10, yeah. 11, 12.
Yeah. I've like found my grandpa's jackknife in practice for a little while. And then recently I had found a chipmunk that I carved years ago and decided to get back into it. And have really enjoyed that. That's very therapeutic. Uh-huh. So, yeah.
How do you know that you need to do something, that you need to right yourself? What do you notice doesn't seem, how do you monitor yourself? This is, a lot of people, this is where the intentionality comes in.
Mm-hmm. You know? So this is a really important thing, and it's part of another group that that I do that I'll mention quickly. The Wellness Recovery Action Plan, the RAP group.
Uh-huh.
Whereas Mental Health First Aid is all about teaching you the skills and the language around supporting other people, right. RAP is about building those self-help tools, right. Identifying the things that you need for support and how to talk to other people about them, and identifying when it is that you need them. So what are the things that upset you or set you off or, you know, rock your boat?
Right.
Because a lot of the times, you know, we shrug something off as not being a big deal, and we don't realize that we're suffering. We don't realize that something is wrong or that we're like emotionally off balance until way on down the pike.
Right.
So trying to be more sensitive to that is really important. If I'm at home and I'm really quiet, I know that something's wrong. You know, typically I tend to be an introverted person. If I'm just walking around town, I'm not inclined to be too talkative or gregarious. But if I'm in my own home or in my family's home and I'm quiet, I know that something's off and I have to put some thought into what happened in my day mm-hmm. that might have made me upset and what can I do to deal with it. If I recognize that even within my own head, I'm having trouble describing how I feel, Mm-hmm. I think it's a healthy exercise to periodically check in with yourself.
Right.
How do I feel right now? And if you're able to like very quickly with words explain how it is that you feel, you're probably doing okay. Yeah. If it's muddled, you're probably protecting yourself from something.
Right, right. And I had to learn that. I put that "How are you feeling today" poster on my office wall for 10 or 15 years, and I would just look up and see, well, I'm feeling this way.
That's a great exercise.
And I would discover that I've never felt this other way before. And it is a good exercise.
Because there's shame associated with feeling sad. There's shame associated with feeling, afraid also. So something that happens a lot is that when we're feeling those emotions profoundly, we redirect it.
Right. Or with the hot emotions like anger or rage or other things that are embarrassing,
mm-hmm.
that are more active. All of those things can be shamed, but mm-hmm. if you can identify them and normalize them, then you can deal with them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think, you know, a lot of anger is born out of fear or sadness that wasn't dealt with constructively early enough.
Right, right.
It's crystallized sadness or fear.
Right. And anger as a healthy matter is a signal that something needs to be addressed here. But mm-hmm. anger as a reflex is something else.
Mm-hmm. Addressing how do you know that you need to do something, I wouldn't even say something like "I feel sad" means that I need to do a specific thing. Because sometimes you need to sit in that.
And to do is to just address it. I mean, how do you mm-hmm. know when you said muddled, when you can't name it, you know, I need to stop now. The muddling is a sense that I don't need to do anything to change my situation, but I need to do something to attend to it.
Mm-hmm. And recognizing that, you know, different stressors are going to lead to different cures. The same way I'm not going to take the same kind of medicine for a cold that I would for, you know, an infection.
Right.
Like you need different medicine for different things. Yeah. You know, under most circumstances, relaxing on my couch with my girlfriend and my puppy is going to cure like 99% of the things that might be going wrong with me. But sometimes I also need to be alone, and that's okay too.
Yeah.
But recognizing which is which is important.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And being alone and being silent by yourself is health giving.
Mm-hmm.
And the proportions you use there is that most of what we do for self-care is at a level where it's just not letting it become a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's when we find ourselves having not attended to not letting it be a problem that we actually end up with a big problem.
Absolutely. When it doesn't get dealt with,
yeah.
Because it's such a reflex to say that it doesn't matter. This isn't really a big deal. I'm going to forget about it. I'm going to look the other way, but you're not, you're just going to internalize it.
Right.
And it doesn't mean that you're weak. It doesn't mean that you're broken. It doesn't mean you should be embarrassed or ashamed. It just means that you're human. And if you can be sensitive to that and recognize like the things that you need to do to not feel those bad ways, then you're a more high functioning person than a lot.
And you're a much lighter heart.
Yep.
Jake, it's been wonderful to get to know you.
Back at you, sir.
And we're going to close with Capital City's "Tell Me How to Live." Do you want to say anything about that before we...
Just that this is one of my favorite strutting songs. Strutting is part of my mental health. I need to do that to build my confidence sometimes, and this is a good song for it.
Here we go. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and that concludes the Made of Clay Report.